This is David Duke. This is David Duke, and this is the David Duke Internet Web Radio Broadcast, broadcasting to the entire world with news and information of importance to Europeans and people of European descent wherever they may dwell upon the earth. And certainly it's of interest to many different races and peoples of this planet who are concerned about globalism and who are concerned about the threat of Jewish supremacism, a threat that means far more than the dispossession of Palestinian people on the West Bank and in Palestine. It also applies to the supremacism of the Jewish extremists in terms of the media of many of the Western countries of the world, including the United States, Canada, Britain, many other nations, and how this supremacy affects our way of life. What kind of society are we going toward? Are we really going toward a society of enlightenment and progress and beauty and culture and heritage? Are we moving toward a dissolution of everything that's important, vital, and beautiful? As you know, DavidDuke.com has a very recent article by a Jewish professor which speaks about the Jewish involvement in pornography. Again, I must say, I am certainly no prude. I think the human body is fantastic. I wouldn't agree with the Victorians who would have tried to cover up Greek statues which show the beauty and elegance and grace of the human body, both male and female. But at the same time, I must say that a lot of the pornography that we have that dominates our society today is pervasive, in fact, in our society. Dominates is a proper word because it exists. I mean, I can remember a time when I was 7, 8, 9, 10 years old and I never even saw a picture of a naked woman. I mean, literally. Of course, that was a long time ago by today's standards. And now it's any kid practically in second grade knows the facts of life, and they haven't just seen some sort of sexual education illustration. And it's not because they go to nude beaches with their parents, but they have literally seen pornographic materials on television. Oftentimes in the movies, magazines of indescribable filth, and that's the only way I can put it, because a lot of this stuff is not simply about the beauty of the human body or showing the grace and even the lustful position of the human body, but it's about every sort of deviance and perversion that you could possibly name. Well, a Jewish professor recently has written a major article, and he basically in there talks about how that the pornographic industry, from top to bottom, from producers, directors, financiers, organizers, even to the point of the actors and actresses, is very much dominated by Jews. An interesting phenomenon, ladies and gentlemen. And they talk about how the fact that this pornographic industry has gone from a very tiny part of the American, of Americana, of the American way of life, to the point now that it's mainstream. It's everywhere. It's on cable. It's in every home. Every kid, practically, has seen pornographic movies, which was absolutely rare just a few years ago. And it's not only the fact that these Jewish extremists have made these movies, as my article shows very dramatically, that even some of the producers of this pornography talk about it in the sense of getting revenge against the Europeans and Americans. That's right, getting revenge against us. That it's somehow an attack on Christianity. Al Goldstein said that it's against authoritarianism and against Christianity, and he used a lot of expletives, by the way, in that, one of the leading pornographers. And I've seen this phrase many, many, many times. I think this was started, to tell you the truth, the whole sexual, so quote, sexual revolution was actually began by Sigmund Freud. I write about this in Jewish Supremacism. I hope that all of you listening have by now read my book, and you can also read some excerpts, of course, on the internet on davidduke.com. And in My Awakening and Jewish Supremacism, both of those books deal with Sigmund Freud to an extent and talk about his influence on Western mores and values and our way of life. And he was certainly a very destructive force toward the family, toward European reproductive rates. And the interesting thing is that Sigmund Freud was an absolute bald-faced Jewish supremacist. Jewish extremist of the worst sort. You know, his hero, and he writes about this himself, and my book gives a lot of his quotes from his own books and from other leading Jewish biographers who are, by the way, very favorably disposed to Sigmund Freud. And the quotes are amazing. He talks about the fact that as a young man, his great hero was Hannibal. And why was Hannibal his hero? Because Hannibal overcame Rome. Of course, Rome was the gens. In fact, Rome comes from the word Gentiles. Rome was the archetypical Gentiles of the Jewish evolution, of the Jewish evolvement in terms of their political, social, and religious point of view. And if you remember correctly, the great enemies that Rome was to Judaism and to the Jewish people. Rome, of course, dispersed the Jews. So the Rome was, I guess, a good equivalent for Rome. Rome was, quote, the Nazis, you know, of the biblical times, of the Mideast times. And, of course, the Romans, again, were a fantastic people. They created an unbelievable civilization, aqueducts, engineering, great works of architecture, great works of philosophy, art. They gave us a lot of our political forms that we, in fact, enjoy today. And, of course, the Greeks did as well. But the Romans certainly refined those principles. The Roman Republic was certainly an example, the very example upon which the United States Republic was founded. Rome was a magnificent civilization. And if you take a look at, and if you go to Rome, in fact, today, and you go to, say, the Vatican Museum, or you can go, in fact, for that matter, the British Museum, or you can go to the museums anywhere in that part of the world, take a look at those statues. The Romans were us. They were our people. They are us. And the Jewish supremacists had a great hatred toward Rome, just like they had a hatred toward us. There's no question about that. And they did everything they could to cause any sort of dissension and so forth and problems within the Roman Empire. And that's a very interesting subject. We can go into a lot of those subjects and some of this aspect of the Jewish aspects of Rome. And of course, the same thing is true of the Byzantine Empire. Of course, when Rome split, and we had, of course, the empire in the west, in what we call Rome proper, and of course we had the empire in the east, Constantinople, or Istanbul, of course, as it's referred to today. And in my book, in fact, I talk about the fact that the Jewish forces in what is now Turkey betrayed the Christian people of Constantinople repeatedly. In fact, they opened the gates of the city to the Turks. This is recorded historically. And there, in fact, there are Jewish writers and Jewish authors who, in fact, brag about these Jewish efforts against the Christian people on behalf of the Turks. Now, again, if things were reversed, they'll just as easily betray Turks on behalf of Christians. I mean, they do whatever serves their interest. There's nothing wrong with the people serving their interest. But there's something deceptive when the people are within another nation's gates and commit these kinds of deceit, this kind of treachery and barbarism. And that's another good example. And in fact, I want to talk about that a little bit, and I think it's a very interesting subject and one that's I think all of us should have an understanding of this. I discuss in Jewish Supremacism, and again, I hope if you have not read the book, you read it very soon, and also My Awakening. And read the part about the chapters on economic and social anti-Semitism. In other words, there's two great reasons for anti-Semitism. One of them is economic and one of them is social. But it's interesting to know that anti-Semitism, in fact, was begun as a reaction to Jewish extremism, Jewish hatred, Jewish supremacism in many ways. It was a reaction to their kinds of intolerance. Now, I know this is not a view that you get in your major bookstores and mainstream, mainstream media. And I don't call myself an anti-Semite, because today an anti-Semite is defined as a person who hates Jews, wants to kill them or destroy them. So I don't define myself that. But to understand anti-Jewish thought and anti-Jewish supremacist thought, you've got to take a look at the historical context that in which it existed. Now, the Jews, of course, came from the Middle East into Greece, into Rome, into Spain, and throughout the entire civilized world. They set up shop. They were refugees, and they were pretty much welcomed by the people of these different lands. They got involved in certain businesses and so forth. And the people in these particular areas were willing to have the Jews be there. In fact, the Jews involved themselves in a lot of finance, and they became very powerful. But they wanted the Jews not to undermine their way of life. They wanted them to conform to their own culture and their values. After all, they were in their country. And so they wanted them to become Christian and respect Christian values. They wanted them to be respectful of the interests of the nation in which they dwelt, which is kind of, I think it's a reasonable request. I mean, if you go and you decide, say you don't have a home and you come into somebody else's home, I think in many ways you try to conform with their standards. You don't tell the people, well, I'm sorry, you can't practice Christianity, because I'm a Buddhist, and therefore we don't want to see your Christian practices. That offends me to hear a Christmas carol in my home. Well, that's kind of what Jews are doing here in the United States of America. They want to hear this tiny percentage of the population doesn't want to hear Christmas carols, and they don't want to celebrate Christmas. They want, because they're thinking about Hanukkah instead of Christmas, and then so they try to take away our simply rights. They argue a separation of church and state. Of course, that's an entirely different issue. I don't think the state should be run by the church. I think we should have freedom, and I think that it's a dangerous thing when a state is run specifically by a church. And a few unelected people in that particular ecclesiastical body. At the same time, religion is part of the tradition of a people, and America has always been traditionally a Christian society. We celebrated Christmas, we celebrated Easter. We've had the values of our civilization, and Christmas carols to me are very beautiful. They're whatever one claims about the origins of Christianity, it certainly became very European in almost every aspect of culture and values. And Christmas carols are so European in their just cultural construct, and they're just the way that they're sung, and they're beautiful. They have to touch the heart, even for a non-believer. The Christmas carol can touch the heart. And they worked very hard, and they still work today, to try to break down. As you know, as I talk about, and I talk about on my website today, a very fine article and a very fine address by Kevin McDonald. I've got that reprinted. This is when Kevin received the Jack London Award. In fact, I was just reading a little Jack London this morning over breakfast, an old article that he wrote, which is very interesting, about some of the Alaskan tribes. When he was in that part of the world and talking about white man's justice. It was a very interesting little article. I admire Jack London very, very much. And The Mutiny of the Elsinore is a very, very fine book, and it's kind of like an allegory as to what's happening in the Western world, in our white world. Call of the Wild is a great study of racial ideas and the idea of breed and culture and this primordial thing that's inside of all living things on the planet. That environment cannot take away. Call of the Wild is a great primer, in fact, for racial ideals. There's no doubt in my mind. And Jack London himself was a great crusader for the preservation of European American heritage in America. And by the way, for the people listening who are not of European blood, again, let me say something to you. Don't be offended because I'm defending and my heritage is a European American. I know that most of you listening want to defend your own heritage, your own culture. Just as the Palestinians listening, they want to see their own land be free and have a Palestine of their values and their forefathers and not of these interlopers who came into Israel, terrorized the Palestinian people, and suppressed them mightily. The same thing is true of all people in the world. I'm one of these people. I don't want to see America with bases in 67 countries around the world. Buchanan is completely right when he coined the phrase, we have to make a choice between republic or empire. But going back to it, let's go back a little bit to the origins of anti-Semitism, and I think it's a very important point, and one we must fundamentally understand. First off, when I was a student at LSU, and this is after I learned very much about the Jewish question, I wanted to make a study of how the Jews dealt with anti-Semitism and how they propagandized our people as to what anti-Semitism was, what its origin was, and what the reasons for it were, and so forth. And LSU has a fantastic library. It's a very old university, and they've got a tremendous library of many old books as well as many modern volumes. And they had probably a whole shelf or two, 100 or so books, I think, on the subject of anti-Semitism, if I remember correctly. And I decided to read a bunch of them, so I checked around and found out the most reputable ones and the most recommended ones. And I read about 24 of those books. It was like a little project I did over one semester because I wanted to get an understanding. And you don't have to read many books about anti-Semitism to realize that most books on anti-Semitism are basically anti-Gentilist, that they're absolutely racist, hateful books against Gentiles, which suggests that Gentiles are just evil people. I mean, it literally, ultimately, it suggests almost like a blood libel that Gentiles have something in them that just makes them to be anti-Semitic. You can go to the internet and look at some of the major Jewish sites and where they talk about anti-Semitism. And I even got one of the audio versions of a Jew that was lecturing these other Jews in Israel in English. Thank goodness, I guess they were Jewish students from American Israel, and they were talking about the causes of anti-Semitism. And basically, because they don't want to acknowledge any error whatsoever on the part of the Jews. So basically, the theme of it was that, well, Gentiles are against Jews and hate Jews just because they are. Just because Jews are Jews. Just for no reason, but simply because they're Jews. I mean, that was the theme of one of these teach-a-thons that you can listen to these things on the web. Do a Google search and you can listen to some of these people. But if you read the books on anti-Semitism, and by the way, well over 90% of the books I read on anti-Semitism were in fact written by Jews. And all the authors, even the non-Jews, were extremely pro-Jewish in the way it was written. Of course, Gentiles learn pretty quick once you find out who controls the media and book publishing and who's going to promote your book on the Today Show or Good Morning America or get it circulated in the universities of the United States or in the high schools, the colleges of the United States. You learn very quickly what positions you have to take. And unfortunately, many, many people are not honorable. Many people want to be stars. They want to be, successful. And you can't blame them for that, but they learn very quickly. And they look at it like a job, and they say they're a writer, and they simply, they write what they think they've got to write to get ahead. But anyway, all these books, well, here's a number of them. Some of the books say that the Jews were hated because of the fact that, they, quote, killed Christ. But other Jews very effectively refute that particular idea, because the truth is that in almost all the cases of so-called anti-Semitism or outbreaks of anti-Semitism in Europe in the modern or the ancient world, it really wasn't based on religion. Far more economics came into it and other social aspects than religion. In fact, the Jews who did not believe in Christ were pretty much accepted in many communities around the Mediterranean, and they were left to do their own thing. And as you know, many communities in the very earliest days, by the way, had multi aspects of religions, and Judaism was simply one more. And then in Christianity, because of the relationship between the Old Testament, they were looked kind of like the elder brothers of Christianity. And some people said, yes, the Jewish elders crucified Christ. But generally speaking, a lot of people said, let them be. Let them have what they want. It's when they got involved with such as opening the gates of the Byzantine Empire in Istanbul. It was when they did things like that that caused a lot of the difficulty and the bad public relations with people, the usury. We have something called loan sharking today, which is against the law, which is exorbitant rates of interest. And basically, there were no laws like that in those days, or very few. Sometimes some kings and some princes tried to rein in the misuse of the public with so-called usury, and but they were the primary manipulators of this, because in fact Christianity itself forbid usury. You know, they said if you lend them money, you should not cause your neighbor, you know, or charge your neighbor interest. So the field was wide open, and there were incredible numbers of abuses. Jews also were always associated with the slave trade, even in those times, not the most reputable of occupations. They were involved in many different nefarious types of things. They were involved in many kinds of organized criminal things, much like today. Few people even know that the Russian mafia is mostly Jewish. And it is called the Russian mafia. It's not called the Jewish mafia. Few people know that the biggest and the most important gangster in the 20th century in the United States of America was not Al Capone. He was a small fry for a few years. The big gangster of the United States who dominated the organized crime scene longer than any other individual, controlled more billions of dollars, probably resulted in the deaths of more innocent people and more murders, was Meyer Lansky, head of the syndicate. Meyer Lansky. And again, I talk about this somewhat in my books. The biggest criminal enterprise in the history of the world has been the oligarchs' thievery of 65% of the wealth of Russia. Now, this is what magazines such as Fortune and many other major Forbes has talked about in terms of the Russian nation. In 2 or 3 years, these Jews got control over 65% of the wealth of Russia. They did it through extortion, robbery, murder, blackmail, just anything you can think of. And international Jewish money came in there. This was the greatest single theft of all time. Well, this has been going on for centuries. Martin Luther, I talk about this in Jewish Supremacism. He points out, and he in fact even wrote, he wrote a lexicon of the terms of organized crime, of the organized criminal terms. And he points out, this is a book that Martin Luther did, and this is the founder of Protestant Christianity. And he points out that almost all these terms had Jewish derivatives names. They had Jewish terms because Jews were so much involved in these thievery, these thefts, con gains, confidence swindles, usury, all these other kinds of criminal behaviors, fencing stolen goods, the whole ball of wax. So this has been going on for centuries. And by the way, it wasn't just Martin Luther, the Protestant Church. There were many different popes who issued edicts, in fact, against what they called Jewish extremism, Jewish hatred. And there were a number of popes, in fact, that talked about the Talmud. And, in fact, Martin Luther, of course, talked about it himself. And the popes said that these were books of hate and that these were anti-Gentile, that they were anti-Christian, and they were vicious. And many popes wrote that. Now, here's where we come into it, ladies and gentlemen. Here's where we come into the reality. Okay, so what does anti-Semitism come from? Well, let's talk about the origins of the term. In terms of racial values, in terms of racial extremism, our ideas of racism as defined by our modern times, the Jewish religion and Jewish people were far more racist than anything that white people ever even thought about. I mean, Christianity was a religion that was open to all people, regardless of background. I mean, if you went into early Rome with early Christianity, you had Christians who were Romans, who were Greeks, who were Spaniards, who were from Gaul and France, Lombardy. You had Christians of all different kinds of nationalities and background. And so Christianity was never limited just to one specific ethnic group, whereas Judaism was really based on race. The priest class, of course, could only be of Jewish descent. And, there's never been a significant Jewish leader in all of history that's ever been a Gentile. There have been many significant Christian leaders, of course, who have been Jewish, and many other leaders in our society. Never a Gentile. And Judaism, the reason why that the Jews were able to preserve their heritage over the last 2,000 years is because they preached a very extreme form of racial unity, of in love for their own people and out hatred for the non-Jewish people. The Talmud is full of these kinds of comparisons, and just vicious attitudes toward Gentiles. I mean, literally, Gentiles were unclean. I when I was in the Gulag, I was reading some of the Jewish Press, which is the largest Jewish publication in the United States of America, and I was reading a column called Halakhic Questions. And I read this because there was another guy in there who was Jewish, and I'd borrow his Jewish Press. And it's always an education, ladies and gentlemen, to read the Jewish Press and to read Jewish newspapers, because there was, I remember one long column was how that Jews, real true Orthodox and true devoted Jews, cannot share wine with the Gentile. I mean, I'm not talking about drinking from the same glass or the same flask. They cannot even drink from the same bottle, even if it's poured in glasses. I mean, that's part of basic, fundamental Jewish law. And the rabbi who was writing the question for this for the Jewish Press was talking about was because sharing wine leads this to intercourse between Jews and non-Jews, personal intercourse, and ultimately perhaps even to sexual congress and sexual possibilities and intermarriage and so forth with Gentiles. I mean, not in the very strongest days of Jim Crow was there ever any codified rules that, you know, that that say a farmer couldn't offer, you know, a black person, one of his sharecropper friends or whatever, a beer, you know, or a glass of wine or whatever. I mean, you know, it's just the intensity of this kind of racial attitude. And as I quote in My Awakening and Jewish Supremacism, I quote very extensively from the Talmud, right out of the Talmud, and I used translated editions, which were translated, in fact, by Jews, and supported by major Jewish organizations. And the hatred is just absolutely incredible, ladies and gentlemen. So the early Christians became aware of this. Now, the Jews never went out to try to convert other peoples. And in fact, if someone did convert, and it did happen some, very small amount, but when it did convert, they treated those people like dirt. I mean, and it's still today, that still goes on. Again, I quote from Jewish Supremacism and from My Awakening, from major Jewish sources where they talk about that today, that even in the Jewish community. And I even had some individuals here who were, in fact, Gentiles, one who was married to a Jewish woman in Israel, for instance, and they talk about the fact that he was never accepted in the Jewish community at all, even though he was, you know, a white, healthy-looking guy. His wife was a Jew, and she was pretty blonde-looking, too, in fact, but he was not accepted because he was the hated goy. You know, well, obviously, you know, so which comes first, the chicken or the egg? I mean, I think that Christianity, again, in fact, when Christians were angry at the Jews, they said, look, we'll welcome you. You can become a Christian. Just splash the baptismal water. Accept Christ and become our brother, and we'll treat you well. With the Jews, you know, there was never any question of that. They never tried to solve the problem by converting the Christians. You see what I'm saying? I mean, they were the ones who were the extreme racist in the question. They were the ones who were worried about preserving their blood. Maybe the Europeans should have been had the same concerns for their own blood, in the way it turns out. You know, one of the greatest writers of our time, and a man that I very much admire, is a gentleman by the name of Kevin McDonald. He's a professor. I think his school is Long Beach State out of California. He's written some wonderful books, the Critique of Culture, The Critique of Culture, and a series of books called The People That Shall Dwell Apart, and wonderful, wonderful books. And they're the best intellectual investigation into the evolutionary development of the Jewish people and the Jewish strategy for survival. And he shows, in fact, that certain Jewish traits and personality traits are something that's even entered their DNA, because that's the nature of life. Even personality traits are somewhat inherited. And he shows this incredible ethnic supremacism and ethnic solidarity. So all the books on anti-Semitism basically say that Gentiles just hate Jews for no reason, that Jews are always just this great enlightenment. Maybe they say consistently, well, the Gentiles are just jealous. Well, you know, if I tell you something, if Jews are doing all these great things for Gentiles, if they're not engaging themselves in organized crime and they're not trying to destroy their institutions or combine with the enemies, such as they did with the Turks and Byzantine, in the Byzantine Empire, you know, why would people hate them? You know, they welcome them in anyway, and if they're good for the economy, they would be pretty much happy for them to be there. Well, the opposition came, ladies and gentlemen, because of the activities, I think, that many were engaged in. And I'm not saying that in all cases Jews were innocent, but they certainly have been kicked out of every country of the world at some time or another. And there's no question about that. All the Western countries, anyway, and most of the Eastern countries where they dwelt in great numbers, at least in the Eastern European world. And ladies and gentlemen, you know, it's like cause and effect. I think maybe they were doing something that caused these kinds of reactions. And the truth is that you can find it on the other side. You know, the Jews are often talking about how that there's a so-called blood libel among Christians, and that Christians simply hate Jews, and they make up these stories such as the Jews kill innocent Christian children, they bleed them, you know, they show their power over them in these satanic rituals, and it's called ritual murder, and they call it a blood libel, is what they call it. And you know, and that's what they say. And the Christians believe in these terrible things against the Jews, and they say that the Jews inherit this evil. Also, it's also called blood libel in the sense that ancestors of modern day Jews had Jesus Christ crucified. So, but the truth is that they themselves teach really a blood libel of Christians. And in this, you don't have to go to ancient texts to find this. You can just find this in modern books, Goldhagen's, Hitler's Willing Executioners, and many, many books in anti-Semitism. Many, many books will tell you all about the evil Gentiles and how Gentiles just persecute innocent Jews all the time. I mean, that itself is a libel against Gentiles. And it says that these Gentiles were so evil against Jews for all these centuries. If I say Jews are evil against Gentiles, I'm going to be criticized, right, as being anti-Semitic. But if they say Gentiles have something inside them which makes them just persecute Jews unjustly, in fact, Jews that are actually, you know, benevolent to the people where they live, then that's supposed to be. you see what I'm saying? You see where I'm driving? Where I'm driving to, ladies and gentlemen? Where I'm going toward in this conversation? We have a complete double standard in the United States of America, and so today I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the understanding and some of the origins of. Some of the origins of so-called anti-Semitism. Thinking about that, and I'm going to go to Stormfront now and take some posts, and then I'm going to take a little bit of mail, and then we're going to call it a day. I'm really glad to be back in America. Mandeville's had a lot of damage here in Covington, Louisiana, and there's still some work to be done on my home here and our facility, our office. We could definitely see if we can get some friends of our organization to come out and help us, and also anybody else that needs help. By the way, I have a very good friend, Howie Farrell. And by the way, James, but if you do this, please post Howie's telephone number. Howie Farrell was a big, longtime friend, supporter of mine. He helped run my campaign when I got elected to the House of Representatives in Metairie, Louisiana. He worked very hard in my campaigns for governor and senator. And his house came through the Katrina relatively untouched, but at the same time, he's, you know, his employment is gone, and he needs to make a living, and he's entered a business with his son and some others to clean up after Katrina, to remove trees and to help do some simple repairs and this type of thing. And so anybody out there that would like to, you know, utilize his help can certainly do that. We'll post his telephone number on stormfront.org, the town hall section. And I urge anybody in the New Orleans area that's listening to the program, if you need some work done around your place in the wake of the storm, to contact Howie Farrell. That's Howie Farrell. A really good Irish gentleman who I've known for a long time and marched beside in the St. Patrick's Day parades on a number of occasions in our Irish kilts. And great, great guy. And a very fine wife, Gloria, and son Howie, and daughter Christy, and they've been close to my family for an awful long time. When I was in the legislature and busy with that, getting elected, my daughter for a while stayed at their home. Daughter Erica and Kristen, in fact, stayed at their home for a while, and they've been a great friend of the family for a long time. So any help? And the truth is, we've been able to do some work around here to get things in shape. And I've got a lot of traveling. I've got a lot of engagements, speaking engagements. And by the way, 99% of the engagements that I do, I receive no honorarium. Sometimes I have to pay for my own airfare and own travel expenses. But that's the nature of the game. I mean, I'm out there to educate people, motivate people, and traveling and reaching people, educating people around the United States and around the world. That's what I do. And that's where some of your money goes that contributes to what I'm doing here. So we need to get our office in shape again in my house, and I need to get this behind me so I can go ahead and get out there on the road again. And if some of you have some good skills, carpentry skills, maybe a few roofing skills, a few electrical skills, maybe for some, you know, some wiring work has to be done. Also some tile work we've got to do. If you'd like to contact us, drop us an email, info44@davidduke.com. That's info44@davidduke.com. Or contact Charles Lindbergh, because he's going to be kind of in charge of the projects to get these facilities, you know, back in good shape. I got to handle it one way or the other. And I guess I could go out and get an expensive contractor somewhere who could do it. But, you know, again, that's going to be less money for what we do in our cause. And some of you might want to come down to New Orleans, but you'd be coming down to Mandeville, Louisiana, and Covington, Louisiana. We have some space in the Covington place if you bring a sleeping bag. And there you do have an air conditioner. You're not going to be really uncomfortable. If you have a sleeping bag, is what you're probably going to want to need. And you could hang with us a few days, and we'll do some work and get the place in good shape. And I'll be happy to spend some time with you when you come down. We'll share a common meal in the evening. We'll go to some of our local places and have ourselves some hamburgers or whatever, and maybe even put a beer back or two. So if you'd like to come down and do that and offer some help. And we're looking for people with some abilities who have some knowledge in construction area, carpentry especially, roofing, drywall, and tile. And maybe a little plumbing, too, if you know anybody that's got those abilities. We've got a little bit of work to do on two places, and we need to get this done. So we're trying to get people to come, perhaps, obviously not this weekend, but maybe sometime around a week from tomorrow, maybe Saturday or Sunday next week. And maybe you could stay 2 or 3 days, whatever you can fit into your schedule. And if we get 5 or 6 good guys, we can get this work done pretty quickly, I think. Also, as I said, I'll be around. I'll be either working on some of the facilities side by side with you, or I'll be working on the radio program or the internet or whatever I'm doing here, the Duke Report, for the organization. But I will definitely make sure that I spend my time, and I will try to come by and eat either lunch or dinner or both with all the people working every day. Where you have a chance to meet with me, talk with me, you know, and pick my brain and do whatever else you want to do while you're down here, just to find out, you know, what I'm doing here, and what my ideas and strategies are, and offer your suggestions as well. You're welcome to come, but I'm looking for people, obviously, who can help us a little bit with this work and who have the talents to do so. Okay. That's about it. Now I'm going to talk. This is from an email from David Fellows, and he says, "Oil deal nets Abramovich $7.4 billion. Pound. That's $13.1 billion. Roman Abramovich, Britain's wealthiest man and owner of the Chelsea Football Club, is as much as $7.4 billion richer this morning after selling his controlling stake in Russian oil company Sibneft to Gazprom, a state-owned gas giant. Mr. Abramovich attended Chelsea's Champions League fixture against Liverpool last night. However, the fans may be disappointed to learn that he's unlikely to spend the cash on more players. A spokesman said this will make no difference to Chelsea." Abramovich, by the way, is very corrupt. And the truth is, you know, there's been a lot of cases against him, and I'm surprised that Russia would even give him that money. They should have just confiscated it. They really should have. I mean, this guy had nothing in 1993. He was a part, you know, one of the gangsters, the organized criminals that seized control of the Russian resources, and it really is, it's really crazy that he would be getting paid anything from this. I think the Russian government, which kind of shows you too that, you know, the Jewish media is always criticizing Putin. And trying to say that he's no good and he's anti-Semitic and so terrible and doesn't have a rule of law, yet he actually pays these people for the property. My friend writes, says, this is from, by the way, from Messiah. And no, this is not. This is from David Fellows. I'm sorry. pardon me. He says, what can I one say? This individual purchased a controlling share of Siberian Sifnov Oil 10 years ago for about $117 million. Now he sells it for $7.4 billion, already earned a fortune in profits from the company since its purchase. If you ever needed proof that the world is a mad place and that capitalism is the craziest part, here you have it. While millions of poor Russians struggle to keep warm and feed themselves properly, this individual has taken from them more money than he could ever need. Here's a quote from the Observer. Market sentiment may suffer if Abramovich doesn't get a good price, but wider public opinion in Russia is likely to be outraged whether he gets his $12 billion, $5 billion, or even half that. Most of the oligarchs acquired their assets at knockdown prices during the chaotic privatizations of the 1990s, and in their own country they are generally seen as undeserving profiteers. And that's from the Observer, Sunday, September 25th, 2005. Yes, not only are they seen as undeserving profiteers, they are undeserving profiteer criminals. And when you steal that kind of money, those billions of dollars, and you realize that so many Russian children today, and these are educated, decent people, by the way, these kids can read and write. They can tell you more about Western civilization, Western art, Western literature, Western music, ballet, symphonies, you know, and even writers than most American children can, and yet they have tremendous rates of malnutrition. I mean, it's a tragedy what's going on here, and those billions of dollars taken from the Russian people. This guy Abramovich, my God, he's a criminal, and he's really guilty of the death of many hundreds of thousands of Russians who, because of the fact that this country has been raped from its resources, you know, don't have the economic wherewithal to have a decent diet and get the decent medical care that they deserve. It's a tragedy. Again, David Fellows writes, there is much talk on this board about Jewish supremacy, but the wretched truth is that Jews are not the ones guilty of practicing supremacy and economic exploitation. The British upper class snobs were not Jewish, yet the rule was every bit as terrible and then some. The caste system in India also tended to keep the mass of people poor and subservient to a privileged minority. These are just two examples from many. To put a stop to all this inequity and exploitation, we need to take some fundamental changes in the way we structure our economies. Well, that's an interesting point of view, and he's right. They're not the only ones guilty of practicing supremacy and economic exploitation, but their tribal methods enable them to, with an advantage to do this. And it causes more corruption than you could otherwise imagine. For a good example is the trading that existed in Spain. And I talk about this again in Jewish Supremacism and My Awakening. And I talk about the fact that the Jews put a monopoly on the trade and they controlled it. They drove any Gentile out of business and then they could control the prices and really rape the people. I mean, theft is theft. And that's just the reality of it. I'm against it, whether it's a Jew or a Gentile or whatever. But the oligarchs in Russia, by the way, happen to be almost entirely Jewish. And I think there is a connection there. I think one of the reasons why China is doing so relatively well compared to Russia in some ways, even though they really came from a long way back behind them economically for the people with a tremendously crowded nation and with very limited resources, it's because of the fact when the Chinese privatized, they used some pretty healthy ideas, you know, and they didn't have this predatory element that we've seen, of course, with the Jewish supremacists. This is from Joseph Morgan. He says, Jared Taylor, in his latest article, Taylor versus Sailor, Survival versus Citizenism, puts it very clearly that non-whites support multiculturalism not for altruistic or universal principles, but because for now it serves their group interests. Non-whites have no inherent attachment to the principles of multiculturalism. As a quotation here, it was at this point that Mr. Saylor evoked principle. He conceded that all other races except whites unashamedly promote their own interests, but he pronounced himself in favor of citizenism or acting in the best overall interests of the current citizens of the United States. Perhaps I should offer a correction. It is misreading of non-white human nature. The whole idea of the civil rights movement was for everyone to dismantle racial consciousness and become a happy band of brother citizens. American whites made a genuine effort at this. At least they passed legislation and struck public poses consistent with it, but no one else did. When whites abandoned their collective interests, it was a unilateral disarmament. every other group rushed to exploit this weakness. Good quote. This is from Kane, 123, 123. He says, Representative and Dr. Duke hit the nail right on the head when he said that most books that talk about anti-Semitism are really anti-Gentile. Anything that implies that misfortunes have fallen on a certain group due to discrimination is really, if you read behind the lines, attacking the group which they say discriminates. They are calling this group inferior. When people say minorities don't make it in the job market or Jews experience anti-Semitism due to discrimination, they're actually subliminally attacking white Gentiles. To have discrimination, you must have a discriminator, and the white Gentile is framed as that discriminator. Notice leftists usually don't accuse black Gentiles of anti-Semitism or accuse Jews of holding blacks back economically. No, white Gentiles are always a scapegoat in every situation. Well, actually, the Jews do tend to accuse blacks of anti-Semitism when they are black nationalists, when they don't fit into that same pattern. They did the same thing, of course, to Mr. Louis Farrakhan. He's not an anti-Semitic individual. He's simply an individual who recognizes Jewish power in media and government and doesn't particularly like it. But I don't think it makes somebody anti-Semitic to oppose that kind of policy. Spartan 2119 says, Hello, Mr. Duke. Any word on when your third book will be out? Spartan, I have no idea. I am working on it. I'm very busy right now on other things, obviously, in New Orleans. But I'm continuing to work on it. I think it's a very important book because I think it's a roadmap to victory. So it's a much, I think it's a vital book for our movement. It's about what we really believe in, what our core beliefs are, why we believe them, some of the spiritual aspects of this fight. The ultimate dreams that we have for our people, for this planet, for the universe, and it's the practical means how we realize this dream. So it's a very important book, but it's not something I'm going to rush, and it's maybe the most exciting book I've ever written, because whereas Jewish supremacism and my awakening was basically a rendition of the problem, an assessment of the world as it is and as it, how it really operates, and the truth of race, the truth of the Jewish question, and then a record of my particular activity about it. And I do talk about some aspects of how we're going to win the fight and my awakening. But this book is a more detailed understanding of the spiritual aspects of this fight, the motivations that we have, the things we truly believe in, what inspires us. And I really believe it's the emotion and the heart which will determine whether or not we win the struggle ahead. Reason is great, and you need reason for your arguments, but you also need emotion. Every great mass movement, political movement in history of the world has thrived from that kind of fuel, and that's what we have to have. This is from Nordic Wise. He says, Hello, Mr. Duke. Great show. I just wanted to comment. It seems to me the tactics of both Jews and blacks are really just very immature. Remember school children behaving this way? They have just taken it to an entirely new level. I think this says something about the level of progress. Really, just the same old tricks the rest of us were taught not to indulge in because they're basically dishonest and have no integrity. And that's from Traven. And Traven, thank you so much. And your comments are always very wise yourself. I know you've been in the movement. We used to say that you're brand new to the movement, but you've been in the movement for quite a while now, and you're starting to really get a deep understanding of what's going on. You're asking the right questions. You're making the right observations, and I'm very pleased with what you're writing here, and I'm looking forward to getting some of that more material that you said you were going to send me. I'm sorry that I've been so busy, but I'm in Louisiana now. If you want to come down and see me a day or two, I would love to visit with you a while. So anyway, that's about it, ladies and gentlemen. I need to check emails for one moment again. I got a bunch. Okay, I got a bunch of things. Let's see. Oh, somebody writes me. This is from Texas T. He writes about the story on Pat Tillman. I don't know if many of you are aware of it. Pat Tillman was, of course, the NFL football player, very Aryan-looking guy, you know, the kind of guy that Rabbi Shmuley really doesn't like. And he loves his country, and he volunteered to go fight because he wanted to go with the Osama bin Laden people after 9/11, and he wanted to go fight, and he was deployed for a while in Iraq. Well, he was killed in Afghanistan, and the government, in this tremendous cover-up, made it appear that he was killed heroically going up some hill against the enemy, when in reality he was killed by his own fire. There's a lot of suspicion about what's going on. They even burned all the his body armor that took the shots to cover it up. His whole death was basically a lie. They were using him to promote, you know, this basically the Iraq War. In actual fact, he wrote letters home and to his family, saying specifically that he didn't come to fight in this Iraq War, which is a war based on lies. He wanted to go fight Osama bin Laden. That he was not going to vote for George Bush. And this is the guy they make into this great, you know, hero. Kind of interesting, isn't it? And some people in the right wing are suggesting that he was murdered because of some of his positions on doing that, because he was talking about the fact he was going to come back and talk against George Bush. I don't know if that was necessarily true, but it's interesting how the government put a spin on everything that happened. I recently started discussing your book Zionism and such with my father. I brought up the 60 million Russians who died for nothing during World War One. I guess he's saying World War Two and One, because it wasn't 60 million. Again, that's an inflated figure, probably around 24 million is what the current estimate is, but it could be lower than that. I think those estimates tend to be higher. And he has no recollection of this happening. I went online to get some information. I can't find any, probably because Google.com and such search engines are very biased. I was wondering if you had any known information on this with sources. I'm hoping that this information will open his eyes to reading your book. I want to help pass the word. This is the only way I can see working with my father. Well, I would look up the Russian gulags. I mean, a great place you can start on the gulags in terms of the Bolshevik imprisonment of the Russian people, of course, is Alexander Solzhenitsyn's books, Gulag Archipelago 1, 2, and 3. And in Gulag Archipelago 2, in Solzhenitsyn, in fact, he actually lists and shows the six top administrators of the Soviet death camps who were all Jewish. I have a picture of that in my book. I would suggest you give them some of the, you can print some of the articles online. Print out the Shmuley article. I mean, that's a great article. And by the way, I'm doing a new revised issue on that, on the print version of the David Duke Report. So I hope all of you are subscribed to the David Duke Report, and you're going to hear a new and improved version of the Shmuley article, and the called, of course, Beyond Chutzpah. Let's see. We got more, a few things. All right, Iraq documentary. I work for a television production company in London called Redback Films, and we're making a documentary on the Iraq War for Sky. Be interesting to chat with you and your views of why Iraq War happened. Is there a good number to call you? Well, that's one more piece of media, and I'll certainly contact those people and talk to them about the Iraq War from the point of view of someone who knows some things. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's about it. We've already gone way over time, about double time again. I do appreciate you very much for being with me, and I think, you know, we're doing such an important work here. And my work is not possible without your support. I hope you remember that. And over the last couple of months or so, we've had no mail going out. We've just got mail service back now. Our internet's back. I hope you take a minute and send us a contribution on the internet. And you can just punch on my page, daveduke.com, and go to where you donate. You could also order my Awakenings, Jewish Supremacism, and, of course, our fantastic DVDs of the 2005 conference. They are magnificent. Over 9 hours on 4 DVDs. That's longer than Lord of the Rings. And it's just a fantastic, entertaining, and the production values are superb. I think you're really going to love it. And you could do those things. And right now our special is that you can have all 4 of the current DVDs from the current meeting plus the 4 DVDs from the previous 2004. All together, 8 DVDs for a total of $100. That is extremely cheap. Are the 4 new DVDs only for $65. So that's about it. I look forward to hearing from you. And we do need your support to continue this program, to pay our internet bills, to pay our mailing bills, our light bills, our mortgages, and the whole bit. It takes money to do this. I guarantee you we're doing a lot for a very little bit of money. This organization including the employees we have here, myself and our employees, makes less, I think, than most business executives, most middle managers in this country, single middle managers. And yet we're producing, look at the volume of material on DavidDuke.com. Look at the volume of material in the Duke Report. Look at the number of speeches that I've made, the number of radio and television appearances I've made, the consulting and the help that I've done with politicians throughout Eastern Europe who have been successful, the teaching that I've done in Eastern Europe. I mean, I can go on and on. And the books that I've written, which I think are tremendous in terms of educating our new people. I can't do these things. I can't be successful at doing without your support. And I'm not telling you just to support me. I'm telling you to support all the people who are doing great work. Don Black is in a financial crunch right now, and he needs your support. Kevin Strom, obviously. All the different groups out there are working. But we certainly deserve some support of yours, and a great deal of it, I think. And I think not enough people in our cause support our movement enough. You know, a lot of the people go to the Christian churches, you know, and I'll donate even tithe 10%. Very few of our people give anywhere near that kind of a level. But the leaders in this movement, they're giving their all. They're really putting their life on the danger, on the line. And they're living a life of very little privacy. They're living a life where you're, you know, constantly interrupted and bothered, because whenever you have a mass movement, there's not only a lot of intelligent and good people, but there's a lot of kooks you got to deal with every day. I'm telling you. People that call you up half drunk, and just that's the kind of thing that goes on. But I've always had my phone number listed. I've always been willing to talk to people. I've always been accessible, and I think that's the way it's got to be. It just goes with the territory, and that's about it, ladies and gentlemen. I will definitely see you, and look forward to being with you on Sunday. Again, tomorrow we're going to have Bob Whitaker, but the Sunday is the big show, so be sure to tune in. This has been an interesting show on anti-Semitism. You might want to send out some quotations on it. Make sure that you read the article by Kevin McDonald. And if you've not read My Awakening of Jewish Supremacism, why don't you take the opportunity right now, go to my website, order it, and we'll get it out to you. We have caught up now. As I'm speaking, we have two ladies working their heart out in the other room, getting the DVDs out that all we had ordered. We finally caught up with this since the hurricane. We've only had power now for a couple days. And so, ladies and gentlemen, we're moving. If you don't get your DVDs that you've ordered in the next, give it a week to 10 days. If you don't get them, then let us know, and we'll take care of it. We've got the records. They're all up and available to us on the computer, and we'll be happy to look up your order. Everything is running good, so if you want to order now the DVDs, you know that we're operating. We'll get these things mailed out. In general, almost every order goes out within 48 hours. That's just our general rule. Sometimes there's something that is back ordered if we run out of some item. But generally speaking, that's what we can do. All the DVDs and VHS tapes are now in stock for the 2004 and the 2005 conference. Look forward to seeing you and hearing from you. Again, Bob Whitaker tomorrow, and then I'll be with you on Sunday. This show is a double-link show, almost an hour, and I'll be going on with you for a long time on Sunday. See you then. Take care. God bless you. This has been David Duke for our heritage and our freedom.